It's out of control. You've got to turn it off.
Something's coming.
Humans are such easy prey.
All right.
Okay. That's such a weak okay. You say it with such gravitas.
Well, I'm troubled.
I'm like, all right.
I'm troubled, so my all right doesn't have the normal oomph to it.
I tried to back you up, and I just didn't have it either. I don't know.
Well,
let's try it again. Just,
all right.
Let's do the intro again.
Take two?
Let's do it better.
All right. Like, this is like doing voiceovers in New York City again. I feel like you're Roger Becker.
I'm getting you back in shape. Come on.
All right.
Shave a half a second off that.
All right. That was much more than a half second I shaved off. Let me try that again. All right. Now,
all right.
Give me another one. That was good. Give me another one where you're in a rage, but you're likable.
Okay. All right. Things on.
3, 2.
All right.
Ooh, that's actually pretty good. That's very Nicholson.
That's what I'm going to go for. That. I'm going to do the Nicholson. All right. From now on. That works.
Right. Hi, everybody. Tony and I flashing back to our voiceover days. I'm not sure what's happening now out there. Welcome to Rated P for Paranormal. Tonight, we're reviewing a movie that, as superfan Kerrig said to us in a message, I think he said it best, Tony. He wrote us, "Wow, what did you guys do to me? I just finished watching From Beyond. Can't wait to hear the ep about this one." Tony, let me follow up on Kerrig's question. What happened to you?
What happened to me? I was a horror fan in the 80s, you know? What can I say? This is not an example of like the typical kind of horror that anybody was really expecting back then. I mean, look, I didn't do anything to anybody. And Kerrig, with all due respect, this is Stuart Gordon's fault. He destroyed your mind is what happened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You just kind of ushered us towards that.
I'm a gateway drug. I'm not the bad drug.
Yes. Well, tonight we'll be reviewing that film. But Tony, check in. Everything okay? Everything good?
Yeah, everything is good. I have no complaints. I'm happy to be doing the show. I look forward to it every week. It gives me a reason to get things done so that I can do this. I really have nothing else to do. And I wish this was all I had to do. Like, I wish this would be
seriously
great.
I 100%.
Just like, I mean, you know, we could research these things all week long, all day. And just the show would just be that much better. So,
oh my God. Yeah. You know, a producer, some interns. We could really, this would be the ultimate gig if this were full time. But it sure is fun and it does give me something to focus on and keeps my mind going. It's super positive experience for me. Even movies like this that can be challenging in a lot of different ways. It's funny, we always stumble upon something that's going on in our life a little bit, or sometimes we stumble onto a subject and it ends up kind of being a theme throughout the episode. And we started tonight just joking about voiceovers for some reason. Just now you made a joke and then we did this whole voiceover booth gag. And today I was talking about on the radio my old career in New York City all those years. And the show Modern Family came up, which was a huge smash sitcom, one of the most successful TV shows in American television history, actually. And I read for the lead in that, which didn't happen a lot for me. The Ty Burrell, the father character, Phil Dunphy. I don't know, have I ever told you this story before, Tony?
No.
So yeah, working actor in New York City. I'm just saying this with people who don't know, who listen to the podcast all those years, and made my living. On-camera commercials was my bread and butter until hosting started to kind of take over. And then like the baseline day job was the voiceover work. And every once in a while I'd get a read for like a film or television show, which of course is fun. And every once in a while within that, I'd pick one off, but it'd be like kind of a day part, small role. And then once out of every 20 of those, I'd get a read for like a big part, like a lead in a show or a movie, like a big major production. So that was always really exciting. So I got a read for this new sitcom, you know, network sitcom, and it was self-submit at first. So I had Colleen, my wife, off camera. She was a great reader because she's a horrible actor. She's like self-admittedly the worst actor of all time. It's like listening to the worst high school play you've ever seen. And I say high school play because not to pick on high school actors, but when there is a kid who's just in the play because they're just like got coerced into it because they're friends, but they're trying to act. Do you know what I mean? Like that thing. So she's like really bad and trying to act at the same time.
I think she just hasn't found the right role, but let's, you know.
So I had coached her like just flat, just say it, which is perfect if you know, if you're an actor, because a lot of times you go into these big networks, the people who are feeding you the lines aren't actors. They're just running the video camera. They're interns. They have no interest in being an actor. Right. So they're unique. They're terrible. So it's good, actually. I wanted Colleen to do it because she was so flat and it gave me a chance, you know, to just do my read. And because that's what I experienced when I go into the network read is someone like her probably. And as a matter of fact, it throws you if the person was a really good actor that's throwing you the lines in a way, because it's not a thing that you're working on with them, right? You just
It depends on what it is, but yeah.
True.
But I mean, like if someone throws you a curveball in an audition and they're not trying to get the job, they're just trying to like let you get the job because you're in your audition.
Yeah.
If they can do something interesting and then it like changes your whole plan.
Yes, right.
Which is fine in a real, like in a real acting work, but in an audition, you can't do that.
Right. If you're really going for something in the scene with the room with the director, then you want a good actor. But if it's just like you're one of the 40 guys in there and you're just trying to do your thing and get out, if the person really connects to you in any sort of way, you're like, wait a second, this person's pretty good, what am I? So anyway, long story short, Colleen, this new sitcom, and I remember my agent calling me saying they want this flat, like underplay this, it's going to be like the British Office, but it's about an American family, and they're gonna make it a straight up like documentary where everything's played super straight. And you might even think it's like a found footage documentary, but it's all comedy. It's all farce. They want to kind of almost trick people. Oh, okay. Okay. So I do the read super straight, funny dialogue, but like really restrained. I get a note from the network. They're like, even more, throw it away more, more restraint. Do it again. Almost flatlined. I get called in, do the read. It was one of those things you got the sense they're looking at everybody everywhere. You know, it was like a big deal.
Yeah.
As I remember it, it was a long time later, watching TV one night, not thinking of it, flicking around, eating dinner on like TV trays with my wife. And my wife, Colleen, starts like quoting the lines on the TV. And she goes, that's what I said. I said that line. And she knew the lines coming up. I go, how do you know that? She goes, I did that with you. And I'm like, really? And it was Modern Family and it was Phil Dunphy, the scene, like the pilot, the opening
scene.
Now, yeah. They ended up changing. What's interesting about that story is how much it had changed. It was very much not, you know.
They had gone with your wife's read, is what they did.
My wife is Sophia Viagra.
She got the job, and that's the story.
I think I just got Sophia Viagra, by the way.
I am out of this conversation for several reasons, not the least of which that's not even a show I've ever even seen. Completely honest, right now. Never saw it.
It's actually really good. There's a couple on it, Mitch and Cam, who might be my favorite two sitcom characters like of all time. They should have got a spinoff. I'm hoping they do at some point because the show just ended a couple years ago. I think it had like an 11-season run, or it was massively successful. Anyway, but what was interesting is how much it had changed, and you can see like as it went through the network development. It's kind of like what they do to bands sometimes. They have one idea about what it's going to be, and then it comes out. It's like, whoa, that is a completely different band.
Yes.
And I couldn't have played that part like he did. He was brilliant. If it had been as kind of dark and straight as they did it, I might have had a shot maybe, you know what I mean? But not that guy. He was just perfect for it. So I don't know. It was kind of a funny old acting story.
I have some story. I auditioned for Fiddler on the Roof once for a dinner theater production.
And did Amelia also give you bad line readings? She's incapable of that.
That might be a show she might not know how to do a great line reading for. I'm not sure. That might be the only one. No, I'm kidding. I have no fun stories like that at all.
You have tons, but this I do know I've said on the podcast before. I remember one time Amelia was going up for a big like national commercial, and I like basically she's like, "Could you help me out with this? Because I'm an actual actor." And you're like, and she knew I was a commercial. I actually had to teach her to kind of act bad. Like I had to teach her, like, you know, like, no, you're doing, you're like, that's too good.
I remember
good.
That. Yeah. That is a problem for her.
Yeah.
Commercial stuff sometimes. Yeah.
There's a funny video that's going viral right now of the basketball player Larry Bird doing a demo when he was in his prime. And the coach goes to him, "So what happens if you come too far back from your head?" And Larry's like, "Well, if I go too far back like this, I got no direction. See, look," and he throws it. It goes in. Like, and he can't even miss when he's trying to miss.
Yeah,
in other words,
he can't.
It's like,
he can't.
That's Amelia.
Lose. Yep. Yeah. But man, I was good in that audition for Fiddler. I'd love to talk about that, but I probably should. We should probably move on. You know, I mean, Junk Drawer. If you're asking, like, what's going on this week?
Yes.
Now it's time for the stuff we didn't get to.
What a piece of junk.
P4P Junk Drawer.
The only thing I really do have in the junk drawer is I caught up with an old show recently that isn't the show you were talking about, but it's a show called People of Earth, which is a show from like 2017 or 2016.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that.
And we just binged the first season and had a blast. It's really fun. And paranormal themed, of course, and you know, something that I don't know. Yeah. If you caught up with it, maybe we could, you know, because there's another season. There's a second season.
I vaguely remember it coming out.
I saw posters for it, and I wasn't just watching TV then.
Yeah.
Or something. I don't know.
I was in a movie with that guy Wyatt Cenac, I believe his name is.
Oh, really? He looks familiar. What was the movie?
You edited probably part of my reel with him, with scene with him in it. It was called Hits, that David Cross movie.
Oh, Hits. Yeah. Well, I saw the whole movie. Sure.
He has a part in that. He's very funny.
Okay. All right.
Anyway, boy, I'm turning this into the Maddie acting hour. I'm sorry.
Well, I think that you're dressed for it. You've got a nice kind of cashmere sweater and kind of ruffled hair. You look like you're going to open a book on your lap and start.
I inexplicably, looking at myself right now, I look like Chris Walken in The Dead Zone.
You really do. He does exactly look like. His hair is spiked up now for some reason.
I've never seen that. I've just got bedhead from laying on the couch watching this
spiky
movie.
Spiky hair and a teacher's sweater. It's amazing.
Where's my cane? I can't do Christopher Walken at all. everyone does Walken except for me. I need, I'm going to take a screen grab of this and post this, because why do I look like Walken is the biggest paranormal mystery of the day.
It's not a bad look.
Well, I guess you turn into him if you watch enough of his movies. That's kind of what's happening.
Right now, I look like the guy that came to deliver your washer dryer. So you're doing a little better.
You look like a newsie.
I do a little bit, yeah. I've got my newsie hat.
You got your Well, would you like the paper, sir? Extracts, read all about it. Blake and
I've played two of those roles.
Did
professionally.
You?
I have, yeah. I played a telegram boy in a play.
Now and, here we go. Here we go. Acting stories with Arkin.
Yes, and I played a newsie on the street in a movie.
How old were you?
That one, I was the movie. I was. I don't know, like 10.
Wow.
12, something like that.
Wow.
And that was in one of a movie my dad was making. We were in Berlin at the time.
Wow.
Making this crazy movie where he was, and they just took me over there, and I was sitting in a hotel for 3 months in Berlin. It was a very strange summer.
So cool though.
The crazy part was that if anybody listening knows who Menachem Golan was, or the Canon Film Group from the 80s and some of the 90s. Do you remember the Canon Film Group? There was a documentary made about this company because they were so crazy. Like Roger Corman on steroids.
Wow.
And European money. And so the set was crazy. It was like a turn of the century gothic kind of movie, so there were stagecoaches and all kinds of stuff, and I almost got run over by a stagecoach.
No. Because
I was handing out like newspapers in the street, running across the street, and I nearly died.
Oh,
and
my God.
My first camera work nearly ended my life. I should have maybe listened to that. I should have maybe taken that as an omen, but I didn't.
That was a sign. The universe is trying to give you a sign that you just bowled
just
right
don't,
through it.
Don't do it.
Next thing you know, you're it's a generation later and you're reading to be the violin in Fiddler on the Roof. The actual fiddle.
The title character of the violin.
What did you play? The fiddle.
The fiddle part.
All right. Well, that was a fun down actor memory lane. And now let's get out of the junk drawer. Let's open the drawer of H.P. Lovecraft. But before we do, Tony, we end every episode with our top three inspired by the movie. Our top three tonight is?
Our top three is honorary Joan Crawford Award for Best Shoulder Pads in Movies.
Oh, I can't wait. Great choice. We'll explain why. Of course, you know why if you watch the movie. Here we go.
Every journey begins in the mind. A flight of imagination. What might lie across the universe? Or within the deepest regions of the subconscious? Dr. Edward Pretorius is about to embark on such a journey. From the makers of Reanimator, from beyond.
Scientists have developed the Resonator, a machine which allows whoever is within range to see beyond normal perceptible reality. But when the experiment succeeds, they are immediately attacked by terrible life forms. Tony, this is H.P. Lovecraft's From Beyond, based on the writings of H.P. Lovecraft, directed by Stuart Gordon, 1986. Again, I'll ask, why did you do this to us?
Well, why not? Is this crossing the line for our viewers, for our listeners, for my dear co-host? Is this, have we crossed into a bad territory for you?
All right, so let's talk about H.P. Lovecraft because I can answer that question in that question. I live barely 10 minutes from Providence, Rhode Island, where H.P. Lovecraft was born and lived a majority of his life and died, even though I think for a time he was in New York City, things like that. So he's kind of big around here among literary people who are aware of literature and things like that, or horror. There's monuments to him. I believe the house he died in, I don't know if the house is still there, but there's definitely a plaque to him in Providence, 10 minutes from me. The river he considered drowning himself in as a teen when he was suicidal, I live on the Barrington River. So I was kind of weird connection with him. From when I first learned about him as a young man, I was always scared of his writing. I've read it, some of it, not all of it, of course, but I've read some, and it always had a very dark kind of nihilistic kind of evil tone to it that made me uncomfortable in terms of, I kind of always wondered, and he was an avowed atheist, I think, but I always kind of wondered what he knew. Do you know, he was one of those writers where it seemed like what of this is fiction? And what of this has he tapped into in some kind of ritualistic magic occult rituals, which there's no evidence that I know of that he actually did that, but I'm just saying how it made me feel.
Yeah, I agree. I think his stuff, I'm similarly interested, but I'm not an expert. I kind of came to him later, though. I didn't start reading him until, I guess, my 30s. there's definitely something morbid and genuinely unnerving about him, but I just, that to me is like, sorry.
It's okay. That's him. That's H.P. Lovecraft.
God, that's H.P. again.
Hello, I'm coming from y'all.
He just never stops calling.
Tony, I'd like you to read for a show called Modern Family 2. I'll be your reader.
Can you play the violin? Well, it's a fiddle. So, I agree that there's something, off-putting about it, but that's kind of what I like about it. I mean, it's horror in the sense that it actually makes you feel kind of uncomfortable, like in sometimes a actually unpleasant way, but that's kind of a thrill too. It feels a little bit illicit. It feels a little bit wrong, but I feel like a lot of that was just good writing. A lot of that's really just him being a really interesting writer, conceptually, and he knew how to push people's buttons, and I think he's admittedly just made up this stuff and stole it from, you know, some of the earlier science fiction writers and kind of cobbled together this Cthulhu mythos out of thin air. It's a work of imagination and fiction. But I know what you mean. It feels like he knew the details in a similar way, like Rosemary's Baby, from a similarly like contentious artist, actually, you know, because Lovecraft has a checkered past in certain respects, as does, of course, Roman Polanski.
Mm.
But Rosemary's Baby also feels like whoever made it knew a little bit too much about how stuff really goes down. How this happened. You know?
Yes, yes. And that's what's compelling about H.P. Lovecraft is his intelligence, his knowledge of science, his knowledge of astronomy, astrology, occult practices, magic with a K, so that it is, although fiction, he did kind of know how it might work if it did happen. Do you know what I mean? He wasn't just some fantasist who sat there with no education. He really educated himself. He was a cloistered man. He stayed behind closed doors and read and read and read and read. So when he did come up with something like the resonator, it was kind of based in the reading he'd done about Tesla, for example, or something, right? So
right. It
does have this power to it in a way. It's a little creepy. And then you could even go a little deeper and just say, like, maybe he didn't even know what he was tapping into and knew, you know, if you want to go down that road.
Well, that's an interesting road. I mean, I would love to talk about that. That's all, you know, deeper down the road, because what he kind of created almost amounts to a philosophy or an outlook that has kind of been adopted by some people. Mm-hmm. I mean, not maybe a complete thing, but it definitely has a worldview attached to it that all his work seems to be talking about. So it is yes, kind of beyond fiction in that regard. I think he is fictionalizing how he really saw the world.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Well, there are characters in this very movie who, you know, the doctor says, the female doctor in this movie, Barbara, played by Barbara Crampton, Dr. Catherine McMichaels, she actually says at one point, you know, my father died in an institution. He was had a breakdown, put in an institution, died, which is exactly what happened to H.P. Lovecraft. So you have actual characters, you know, doing the bio of himself. He's writing through his character. So yeah, you're right. There's a lot that ties in there.
And Stuart Gordon, you know, who made the movie, also, I think, is also a very smart guy, the director. You know, he studied Lovecraft. He made most of his films are Lovecraft based movies. He hasn't made a bajillion movies, but he's made Reanimator, which he's most famous for, which is his first movie, believe it or not. Wow. You know, it's also H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah.
And other ones are too. But he's also a smart guy, you know, like he's a literate guy. His background was in theater. Like he started a very well-known underground Chicago theater group called the Organic Theater back in, I guess, the 60s. And it was after the Democratic Convention. It was in 68, I guess, where everybody got beaten to hell. And got real fired up and started, you know, doing politically based, really like, really intense, groundbreaking avant-garde theater and stuff that got noticed and actually got shut down. Like his play about Peter Pan that he put on, which was like a crazy LSD version of Peter Pan, where Mayor Daley was like Captain Hook, apparently, got shut down by the police for obscenity.
Wow.
He was also like David Mamet's buddy growing up and stuff, and did David Mamet plays, you know, as a director. So, I mean, he's a smart guy.
Yeah.
And similarly seems to have an outlook on life that lines up here. And to me, that makes it a really interesting movie and a good combo. I don't know. Like, have you seen it before?
I have never seen this movie before. I saw Reanimator.
Okay.
And
as
and
a kid or?
Yeah, a teen.
Yeah.
Teen. I haven't revisited it since. I want to. I almost, like, I thought we might do it for this, but I'm glad we did this one because it was a blind spot for me. If you remember last week, I actually thought it was like I thought it was a part two of Reanimator because I got confused. I knew there was a name of that machine. I'd heard about this movie, and it's the machine in this movie sounds like Reanimator to me. You know, so I was like, didn't he make a second one in the same director? Okay. So my mind was kind of muddling them together. So
and he did make a Reanimator too.
Well, right. So it was kind of confusing for me. But no, I had never seen this film. Thank goodness I had enough. You know, it's funny that worldview. We'll get into that at the end. Because I have thoughts on that too. And first of all, I'd like to ask you a question. I know you've already got another film in the works, but and I think you might have an opportunity for me within that film, like Sender. So maybe not this next one, but in a film you make, please, I beg you as a friend, the only thing I've ever asked you for is, can I do a scene where the first time you see me, I open a door in a robe and an open robe and no clothes on. And you can just see me crop me about cowboy. And I just want to open the door creepily and stand there with no shirt and a silk robe on. Can I please do that scene?
I don't see why not. That sounds like a pretty easy one to say sure to. I mean, I want to see that. I'd like to, you know, that's easy. We'll probably have some conversations and we'll go back and forth with memos and stuff with the agents in terms of like what level of nudity we're talking about. I think there'll be a request for more than briefs or less than briefs. But and honestly, like, we shoot, most of the stuff is going to be shot 8K now. So we shoot really wide and then we can crop in. So
right.
I can promise you that at least regionally, the regional cuts.
Yep.
For USA market.
Full on.
Cowboy shot above the waist. Won't release. Just see the hips.
Okay.
But Europe, they'll probably want more.
Well, I can tell you who I'm going to base my performance and look upon.
Well, there's a couple of examples of that kind of thing here.
Oh, like when he's just standing naked. And all right, so let's get into it. So this film is a humdinger, boy. It's one of the most fun, you know, you've said this before. You're like, it might be the funniest movie I've ever seen, and yet completely disturbing. Yes. And I wonder how much of that is, I swear to God, when I watch these scenes now, I just picture you picturing my reaction to it.
Oh, yes. I was thinking about it on this last viewing extensively. The shock and horror. Yes.
And like how I just like run to confession as soon as I see it.
It's, yeah. I actually kind of, well, I mean, that part's on you because you already know about Lovecraft, you know,
right.
Like,
yeah, I knew it was coming.
The worst parts of this come from H.P. Lovecraft, because in a lot of ways, this is kind of a campy reimagining comedy version of Lovecraft.
Yes.
And that's how it plays. Yes. I don't take it seriously, but I really enjoyed the movie, but I think they're all, you know, making it's kind of a satire on all of it. And so, you know, the really evil stuff doesn't come through, which might be my only complaint about it, except it's such a funny movie. I don't know if I'd want to change. I don't know if I'd want to change it, but it would be nice to see at some point, and we can talk about this later, like somebody tackle the same, kind of the same structure of this, but more seriously.
Yeah, I mean, and so many have, whether they knew they were referencing Lovecraft or not, you know,
right.
Just opening a portal.
Sure.
And, you know, you look at like Aleister Crowley and things like that, trying to open portals and let in demons. And like that idea is, you know, ubiquitous in horror.
Yeah.
I think, go ahead.
I should say it has actually been, this story has been redone in terms of, being adapted into Banshee Chapter, which was a pretty interesting, somewhat found footage kind of sci-fi horror movie.
Yeah. So, I mean, this movie, I think you're right. I think they did want to gross us out. Clearly, I think they did want to make legitimate points about, you know, human sexuality and sensuality and repression and oppression and self-harm and relationships and a lot of different themes. But I think they wanted to have fun and send it up along the way. I mean, these characters are so over the top at some points, the way they run downstairs at some point and the camera's like on I don't know what they had it on. You probably know, to get that shot of them running down the stairs when he's chasing the old lady and him are running out of the house.
Everything was probably handmade by some person in Italy who just made it, you know, like some kind of weird shoulder harness.
That's us thinking,
you know, Because they shot this all in Rome. I mean, that's where they got the money. So it has this great flavor. I love movies that are cross-pollinated like that, where it's like an Italian production shooting in America, like you had for some of the Giallo movies, or, you know, or this, where it's an American team going to Rome with like Roman art direction, like Italian craftsmanship on some of it, and then just weird no money budget on the other end. It's really cool.
It takes place in like a fictionalized New England, and you are so clearly not anywhere near New England. It's
or
like
the LA, like you don't know where you.
Yeah, you don't know where.
And when you have that vibe watching a movie, it's probably in like you're probably in Eastern Europe somewhere, or in like, you know, you know, at that time, maybe Vancouver.
Super, super fun. So we meet these two doctors, and the creepy doctor I'm talking about is the mad scientist who opens the door in a robe and no shirt, and his assistant, they've built some sort of contraption, and it's working because it has unveiled or unleashed from another dimension or somewhere these animals, these like floating jellyfish and eel looking creatures that actually bite the assistant. So he runs to his, you know, Dr. Frankenstein, if you will, and says, we did it. The machine works. That mad scientist ends up getting eaten by one of these creatures, and his assistant ends up in a mental institution. Assistant who's in the insane asylum meets a female doctor who early on I was like, oh, this is interesting, because one of the scenes I loved is she takes him very seriously. And I loved that. I loved that about that scene. They do a good job, I think, in that moment of like showing the sorrow. H.P. Lovecraft clearly wrote about that, like the sorrow of insanity, the sorrow of schizophrenia, the sorrow of mental problems. And she's walking down the hall hearing the cries of those people. And it was very powerful. I was like, wow. There was campy moments up till then, but I was like, wow, that was...
Yes. I'm sorry, but it's capped by one of the funniest moments in the movie, though.
I know.
Is her reaction. There's one of the inmates is doing something very naughty in his cell.
To himself, if you will.
If you've seen Silence of the Lambs, you know what I'm talking about. And she has a reaction shot to this. That's it's the funniest thing. That's when I knew, I think this is when, you know, this could actually be a comedy.
Yeah.
Like that. They know it's a comedy.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
She just kind of goes, oh, and she's just disappointed and kind of like, I mean, like you're in an insane asylum. I don't.
Yeah.
This is the last thing you should be surprised at, but whatever.
It's a little bit of like church lady tisk tisk, and yet she lingers for an extra second and watches for another beat. So you're kind of going, oh, wow.
I know.
And which is actually crafty little filmmaking, because what we learn about her is that she does have this.
She's a little repressed.
She has a repressed desire, a repressed sexual beast inside her waiting to take form. So it's very slick, because, you know, she's first tisk tisk, and then she kind of gives an extra little look, and you're kind of like,
she should just
walk away.
I know.
And before that moment, I don't know if you noticed this, she walks through sliding doors, or, you know, doors that open. They actually make like the Star Trek sound.
It is the Star Trek door.
Thank you.
Literally.
So that was obviously a nod or a wink or a, you know.
Yeah, a little joke.
Fun.
Like,
yes,
it's just
yes,
a little joke.
Yes.
It's so playful. I mean, the movie is really so playful.
It is.
And I feel like, you know, when you start watching this, you're probably going to be in Kerrig. I can totally understand. Like, this is weird. If you're not expecting this, if you weren't, you know, if you didn't connect Stuart Gordon with Reanimator and you hadn't seen Reanimator, this would probably feel like, you know, Tony and Maddie went completely off the rails to recommend this.
Right.
But, you know, it really did, you know, Stuart Gordon's stuff really did make an impact back then. And it was kind of primarily because it was so sexual and overt. And, you know, it's weird because we don't make movies like this anymore. And there may be a good reason for that. I'm not going to have that conversation. But I think it's interesting to look at movies from a time where an R rating got you some really weird stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, yeah.
Really weird late night stuff, like cable access weird late night stuff. And those of you out there old enough to know what cable access is, you know what I'm talking about. And so I kind of have a love for this. Like, yeah, it's a voice you just, this voice wasn't heard a lot. So when it came out, especially in a genre movie that was well reviewed and taken kind of seriously at the time, in the conversation with like Hellraiser for sure.
It's so funny. It reminded me so many times of Hellraiser from the set of the house, the wood floors, the beasts that were eating themselves, and dripping dread of the costumes. And
the style of the makeup effects too.
Yes. The wetness of it is very wet. Yeah. Movie.
Gooey. It's very goopy.
It was gooey and goopy. Yeah. And the repressed, found sexuality too is something that Hellraiser, the S&M.
Right. Exactly. Aspects. Which also is, you can see in like Videodrome and The Brood, which are, Cronenberg movies. And then also this movie we talked about last week, Possession, or the week or two before, Possession, which was a European movie about a possession, which also has really weird sexual overtones. And there was a lot of these movies at that time from a little niche group of filmmakers, and they dared to kind of take stuff into a realm that was like, for the first time, they could show you kind of illicit stuff in movies. And I don't know. I mean, it's kind of tame by today's standards in terms of what you could just click on any site in the world online, but
and yet you're right. We wouldn't see anything like that. Like it would be very rare to see some of the scenes be as prolonged and strange as those scenes are nowadays.
Yeah, really, truly. And as as weird or kinky as even Netflix can get, it just doesn't feel like it always feels like you're in safe hands, or like they're never going to show you anything too, it's, and this kind of movie has that quality, which I admittedly love in horror movies, which is you don't really know if you're in safe hands, or like, is the director crazy? Like, am I going to see things I really don't want to see?
I agree. Sorry. I have been converted to that side of the fence with you throughout doing this podcast. I didn't realize it consciously, but what I do enjoy about these films is I don't know what you're going to show me next. And in way too many movies, like last week's series we reviewed, I know exactly what I'm going to see next.
Right.
Some variation or iteration, even if it's a little different than what I thought, it was still predictable. And in this movie, like, did I expect her to get into S&M garb, off the bald, burnt, radioactive dude as soon as she's done off, sniff her own finger? Did I expect that? No. Did I expect to watch a man have his penile probe bit off by a crazy hot chick in bondage? No, I didn't expect that. I'm sure Keurig didn't either, but that makes it so grand.
In the future, I guess for Tony's recommendations, you all could Google the movie, check out IMDb, see if maybe it's, because I don't always know when I've gone too far. It's admittedly a problem. I have recommended films to the wrong people sometimes, and people have called me like going, "What are I went on a date to see such and such."
My God.
And they would say this, and I'd be like, "What's the problem? I don't understand what's the problem?" That, like, Saving Private Ryan is not a date movie, okay? It's just not.
It's Naked Gun coming out of a platoon laughing. Something tells me I'm
in. So I admit I have this problem, and I do apologize to anybody that feels abused by my tastes, but
no, it's super. It was super fun. Back up a little bit. This guy's in the insane asylum. He meets his female doctor. She doesn't think he's crazy. She might think there's something to this. So she says, let me go back to the scene of the crime and reconduct the experiment that unleashed what he says was unleashed. And of course, as would happen in real life, they release the man who's convicted of an axe murder and possibly eating the guy's head with a female doctor, and just let them walk out the parking lot of the hospital, and which, because that's what you do. And they meet a police officer who's, I guess, assigned to them, a cop named Bubba. Is that what his name is?
Yes, Bubba Brownlee.
Bubba Brownlee.
And played by the great Ken Foree, or Foray. I don't actually know how to pronounce it.
Hilarious. And so they go back to the house, and there's a scene where Jeffrey Combs, who plays this guy Crawford, the assistant, he kind of just disappears. And Bubba and the doctor then go, where'd he go? And Bubba literally goes like this. He looks left and looks right, and he goes, damn it, we lost him. He doesn't move. He doesn't look for him. He's been gone for literally 4 seconds. I mean, like, yeah. 4 seconds. And he goes, damn, we lost him. You didn't even look for him. And I just went, oh, yeah, okay. So this movie, again, I've said this before. It's like there's certain times the Star Trek door closing, I go, this movie's aware of itself, I think, unless they couldn't afford the soundtrack. Her look into the thing, I go, I think it's aware of itself. And then that, I go, okay, this movie's having fun.
Yeah. Yeah, truly it is. I mean, they do look like they're having fun. And you know, these actors showed up for Stuart Gordon a lot. You know, it's like he must have been kind of fun to work with because he made Reanimator with the same group. He made this. They all returned again for another movie. He wanted to, like, have a stock company of actors that would do H.P. Lovecraft movies. That was his dream, you know. So I think they did have a good time. It really looks like they did.
It sure does. And Jeffrey Combs is such a unique actor. We saw him and talked about him, Tony, when we reviewed The Frighteners. He played that weird FBI agent with such affect, so many tics, just so many weird details about that character that he clearly invented. And then this character is the same. Just he's kind of a tour de force of an actor. He's relentlessly watchable. You know what I mean? He's
yeah, incredible. He is. He's got a little bit of that. I'm gonna totally blank. You're gonna have to edit this out for a second.
No, no worries.
Because what movie was I thinking of? There's an actor he reminds me of. I can't think of him. It's hard to imagine anybody else in this. Like I don't know where you'd cast Jeffrey Combs other than in something like this.
Yeah.
And it made me feel a little bit bad watching The Frighteners in the sense that I felt like he didn't have a director there who was on his side who could really make use of that kind of performance, which he can give so well. I mean, very few people can really completely give themselves over to melodrama to that level.
Yeah, like...
And commit to that level where you're doing what in any other movie would be considered just bad acting.
Right.
But in this would be considered just the right level of bad acting and
yes.
Tuned just right for the hysteria of a, you know, a crazed scientist movie, you know, that's got, you know, a little bit of like Dirty Midnight Madness to it. You know, it's just a little bit wrong.
I can't believe, like, you know, I know what you mean by that. And I know you kind of mean like bad in quotes because he's not a bad actor. It's
no, he's very good.
Right.
You know, yeah.
I know exactly what you're saying. And I was thinking what he does in a sense and this is not sacrilege, but what he does in a sense must be as exhausting and as difficult as like what Shelley Duvall did in The Shining, because every single moment he's on screen in this movie, he is emoting absolute terror or just over the top concern or whatever it is, but he's never just kind of delivering dialogue or walking into a room.
No, once. He's on 11 when we meet him,
yes.
And he just goes farther and farther.
It's gotta be exhausting.
And he's incredibly exhausting. And he's a theater-trained actor. He's I'm sure done all the classics and stuff. He's obviously like a very talented actor who just knew how to give Stuart Gordon the right kind of. They're satirizing bad acting, I think, is what, you know, that's like what melodrama can really do. It's like you can actually make a kind of a fun comment on how ridiculous people are and how, you know, ridiculous our reactions are to things in life by making them melodramatic. And it takes a very special actor to commit to that without feeling embarrassed, you know?
Yeah. Oh, there is no shame in his game. You can
None.
Tell.
None.
You know, it's funny. I used to tell people when they sing karaoke for the first time, like friends of mine or something, like, or male relatives of mine, it was like, I'm not going up there. It was like, you have to. They put your name in. I always say the same thing. I'm like, you got to commit 100%. It doesn't matter if you're the worst singer in the room. Everyone will be deeply uncomfortable if you're kind of trying to cool your way through it. You know, I'm like, you just got to commit 100%.
Yeah.
Pretend you're the only person in the room. And like, he's got that level of just like, there's nothing that embarrasses him as an actor. Or
depends on what you want in karaoke. I like the awkward ones. So I like those awkward karaoke nights better than you just like champions.
No,
that's the problem
no.
with us is that you like champions and I like losing people who just muscle through sadly and try to do it. That's to me the funniest and greatest thing to watch.
I was just setting them up to be crushed. I was trying to get their hopes up so I could watch them flame out. Then this film becomes like a hellraiser. It's almost like becomes like a chamber piece in this house of them battling this machine and this demon that's come forth from the nether world, wherever it comes from. And it becomes this kind of like John Carpenter thing, just mess of goo and monsters eating themselves. And it just all hell breaks loose with this whole subplot of sexuality. And like I said, S&M, the female doctor starts kind of being possessed, I guess, almost by this entity, the spirit, her pineal gland is engorged, as is...
Can we call it the pineal gland, please?
I don't know. I think pineal gland is way more accurate.
I would, just for the show, I'd like to call it something.
As he's talking to her in certain scenes, his pineal gland extender rod is flopping on her face as he's telling her how beautiful she is. It's just kind of like spanking her in the face.
This thing is just so incredibly amazingly wrong.
Which she proceeds to bite off. Ugh. I mean, it's crazy.
It goes farther than you think it should, and then it goes a little bit farther. And it knows it's doing it. It knows it's ruffling your feathers. It knows it's doing things that you've never seen.
Yeah.
And it was very intentionally trying to do something on camera in a movie. You know, and like, you know, seriously, because there's something very funny and ridiculous about all of that, of course. But seriously, from the standpoint of kind of like art vibe that I really dig, which is surrealism. You know, I love surrealism. That's kind of a thing I've always been into. I like surrealist art and film and to a certain extent literature. And I when you see something that's legitimately designed like that, it's very exciting to me. I love that subversive quality. I love a filmmaker that's gonna do not just the safe thing, but actually go farther out onto the ice than anybody else would really dare to go. And not just in terms of taste, although that's kind of funny too, but in terms of even subject matter. You know, no one was really, you know, making popcorn movies about, like, there were art movies about our sexual identities and stuff, I think, more than there were, you know, crazy genre popcorn midnight movies that were dealing with societal things, I think, that Stuart Gordon was taking seriously. I mean, I don't know. Do you feel like, what do you think he's saying or riffing on here? Is there anything particular to the time or, like, what's on his mind?
I think a bunch of things, repressed sexuality is certainly a theme, and societal pressures to do certain things, and what we think of as like healthy situations is being just kind of just steamrolled over. You know, like what is happening behind closed doors, you know, is way different than what we present to society.
And, okay, right.
And like her whole buttoned up doctor thing, you know, when she gets in that house and that door shuts, man, and that machine gets turned on, like,
right,
all hell breaks loose. And then she's challenged by that, because the cop character, interestingly, has a really incredible dramatic moment with her when she's dressed in the S&M. She's kind of possessed by the machine, and he grabs her, look at you. Is this who you are? Is this really who you are? You know, and I guess the lengths we go to fulfill our earthly desires would be in their mix. I think Lovecraft had some definite opinions about what we were as humans, and that we're pretty animalistic, which I disagree with, but I think that's how he saw the world. So yeah, I think there's a lot of stew in there. What about you? Like, what do you think?
I agree with you on that stuff for sure. I think it was when I was reading about Stuart Gordon's background with activism and you know, his organic theater stuff, which was like, sounds like it was kind of like Mary Prankster stuff. Like,
oh,
you know,
right. Yeah.
Really troublemaking, but for for the right reasons.
Right.
Let's say, challenging the status quo. He seems to be a person that really wanted to do that consciously. And I think he was trying to do that consciously in his movies. And, what I got out of it was actually like, knowing that, I looked at the drug angle here more. because this repressed sexuality is accessed in this movie through the use of this resonator, which could be a stand-in for heroin or other hard drugs. And I'm like, something about this movie feels like it's an FU to Nancy Reagan's Just Say No. Huh. Or that it's like Stuart Gordon was sitting there going, I hate Nancy Reagan's Just Say No campaign so much because it's so full of crap. What would be the movie I'd love to make to show her? Like, or what's her nightmare of what this is?
Interesting.
This is Nancy Reagan's fear of what LSD will do to you. Or this is what Nancy Reagan thinks happens when you smoke weed, or you know what I mean?
Or like the squares with the...
And that's, yeah. And I found that to be kind of a key to making the movie really funny for me, was like, it's as if it's her nightmare. It's not Stuart Gordon's movie. It's
It makes sense too, because it's like plugging in, tuning in, you know,
right,
plugging in the machine. Another thing that comes up is that it hit me too is, and this makes total sense with Lovecraft's history of mental illness and stuff in his family and his own mental illness battles. He had a self-described breakdown as a teen. His life got really bad really fast as a young man, and it definitely scarred him. Although he had visions and night terrors and stuff and problems before all that happened, when he had a kind of idyllic rich life in Providence, he was having issues. So it wasn't like it was all caused by it, but it's certainly exacerbated by his tragedy in his life. And both his parents suffered from mental illness. Both, I believe, died in the same asylum or an asylum. I don't know if it was the same one. Wow. In Providence. And he battled it too. So there's definitely a theme in this movie too about shuttling away the mentally ill. And it's really driven home in that opening scene. I think the whole thing is a bit of an allegory for what we do with mentally ill people and how we don't address it. And that, boy, that's a message we could use now, to the point where it carries throughout the whole movie. And I think when she kind of bursts through the window and at the end, spoiler alert, and kind of saves herself, she also goes insane. And it's almost like the machinations, they try to electroshock therapy her. There's an evil doctor. Like, all the machinations of the healthcare system, how we treat mental illness, ends up driving the very professional who's in it insane by the end of it. So right. I think that was on his mind too. How
well,
we treat mental illness in this country.
That makes a lot of sense. And also, like, knowing that a big key to cosmic horror itself is the idea of madness.
Mm.
Is the idea that, you know, when you confront the reality of space, or the, you know, what's behind the curtain, you know?
Yeah.
It's so terrifying that you go mad and your brain can't take it. I mean, that's right. That's the key of all, I think, Lovecraft cosmic horror, is this ineffable, undescribable dread of seeing what you don't want to see. And then you can't come back from it. It's not a depressing movie. It's not, you know, it toys with this outlook, but it doesn't really...
No. Yeah, I agree.
Make you feel that way. And I think by taking it to melodrama and making it kind of a black comedy about sexual issues, mores and issues of our time, it saved it from being probably what he never wanted to make, which is a depressing, sad trip to hell, which is what a lot of Lovecraft really probably was.
Yeah, and you just triggered something I meant to say too, and you asked me what it's also a love story, and I wonder how you know, I know Lovecraft was, like, for example, pretty adverse to sex. His wife described him as, like, pretty asexual. And I think he had a bad view of relationships and what they meant. So it's funny. This is a love story, though, despite all that, with the doctor and Jeff Combs' character, Crawford. And it's actually kind of sweet in amidst this tremendous gore. Like, he gets eaten by the monster and he gets rebirthed. His fingers come out through the mouth of the monster and he pulls himself out of the monster and goes, like, run, you know, get out of here. And he's all gooey, and then the monster's eating itself, and it's like, oh, is this whole thing about what relationships do to you?
Yeah, there is definitely that joke too, man. There really is. There's a movie called Society from around the same time that's a cult classic, and is not as exciting throughout, but it has an ending that has been written about and talked about for 40 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll check that out with
goggles. Well, tread with caution. It's out there.
I'll check that out with my fast forward button greased.
Yeah.
That's all that'll be greased after this movie. When she sniffed her finger, dude, I was laughing so hard thinking of you, thinking of me watching it that I just couldn't. I couldn't. And when she bit his pineal gland off, or however you say it, I was just in
I don't
heaven.
Know how you say it. I'm just asking that you say it a different way.
Sure you don't.
I'm not an expert on that gland.
Your forehead looks like it's pulsating right now. What the hell's going
Stop
on?
Stop it.
I mean, isn't that every man's worst nightmare to have your penile probe get bit off by a...
By a woman in leather studs.
Not sure, too, why Bubba had to run around in his jockeys, but hey.
They went full into the themes and metaphors at their disposal. At all times.
Well said. Anything else about this movie that we haven't got to, Tony, or little facts or something that you wanted to talk about?
I think it's worth just mentioning what I think they did a great job with the art direction of the resonator itself.
Yes.
And yes. I mean the effects are pretty great. They're great examples of 80s, you know, monster effects, like really fun. And some really creative builds, like the classic Pretorius face melting, you know, thing with the stock head is fantastic. I mean, it's really classic. Of its kind, it doesn't get a lot better. And I like I wasn't a fan of the lighting throughout. I have to say my one complaint may be that it was super overlit for whatever reason. I just think they threw a lot of light where they didn't need to, but, the Lovecraftian light, the neon effects and stuff were great. I thought they captured
okay,
that.
Yeah.
And, that was a different technology they were using to do that. That was in camera and different. You don't see stuff that looks quite like that. It's all done differently now. So it's kind of cool to see them do a really good job with those kinds of effects in camera and on the set.
Yeah, like the pineal gland view was kind of this like 80s VHS post-production effect.
How many times are you going to say that?
As many times I possibly can. As we head to the tip of the pineal.
So I've got to say we said a lot of good things about it. Do you have any cons? Anything like that you think could have been better?
Oh yeah, it's a terrible movie.
Okay. Yeah, it is a terrible movie.
But I had a blast and I laughed my ass off.
Yeah.
There's a scene at the end when the monster, when he emerges from the monster that I was just talking about. But then it turns into a fight, you know, the two people are fighting each other as this blob. And there's one part where it's just gyrating like a huge ball of jelly. And it almost looks like two men having sex. Like the bodies are kind of...
It does kind of evoke that, yeah.
It's just, I was laughing out loud. Like, I go, this movie has just, it's just pushing.
That's what I'm saying. Even the stuff you're like is bad is actually good.
No, yeah, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the hell out of it, that said. But yeah, no, I mean, you know, the acting is completely melodramatic. It's gratuitous. It's grotesque.
I think it's funny that you know, they have this elaborate set up in the attic with the resonator and everything. And then Pretorius' sex dungeon is like the cheapest, worst.
Yes.
Sex dungeon and
the like
movie.
One pair of leather cuffs.
It's just awful. A big like pop art picture of a guy in his underpants. It was like,
yeah.
And I love the fact that's where Coombs' bedroom is, that he stays in that room.
Right next to the leather boots. He sleeps
in this giant institute. Like there isn't another bedroom or a wing where people stay. No, you can stay in the sex dungeon. There's a fridge, there's a mini fridge.
Did you have like a favorite line? Because I mentioned my we lost him. Damn it, we lost him.
I do. I have a weird favorite. I'm a big. There's a little tidbit for you. This is kind of fun. So there's an actress in the movie named Carolyn Purdy Gordon, and that's Stuart Gordon's wife.
Oh,
they had worked together back in the day. Like I keep talking about this theater company, but like she was in that production of Peter Pan that got shut down.
Okay.
And they were working together, directing and acting and stuff for years and years and years.
Who does she play? She
plays the evil nurse who gets her eye sucked out at the end.
She's great. The Nurse Ratched type character.
Exactly. Yeah. Nurse Ratched type. Dr. Block, she plays in this movie. So there's just a moment that typifies the melodrama to me and the kind of crazy, cracked writing going on here, where at the end of the movie, Dr. Michelson, or no, Dr. McMichaels, gets back to the hospital. She's taken back to the hospital. And for whatever reason, this nurse hates her. And, yeah. and like, she says, Dr. McMichael says some line like, you know, well, I think it's because of the resonator and it's increasing the strength of the pineal gland. And Dr. Block says, God, I've got my notes are all over the place. I'm completely destroying this.
No,
yeah, and Dr. Block says, you always have the answers, don't you?
Yeah.
And I love out of nowhere hostility in movies and in dialogue. Like, there's no reason for this. They didn't explain that they had a problem before. There's no reason for this outburst, but I just love that they went right into the teeth of it.
She calls her like Wonder Girl or something. Cause
yeah.
I guess she felt like that doctor was a hotshot doctor, you know, maybe had a good reputation. She keeps kind of like, whatever, Wonder Girl.
Listen, Wonder Girl.
Yeah, whatever. I don't think it's that, but you know what I mean.
You always have the answers, don't you?
Yeah. Like, what? Yeah. Wait, what?
First of all, she's a nurse. This woman's a doctor. Like, I don't... What? Yeah. Anyway, yeah. That made me laugh.
It was just a blast. At the end of the day, though, this is a tough one because, like I said, it's bads in quotes. You know, it's a bad movie. But it's also not in a lot of ways. It's super fun.
Well, I would argue, how could a bad movie make us talk this much about it and have this much to say about it? Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
to
maybe.
Me, that's kind of an example of a not a bad movie is one that will keep you talking about it for an hour. And
well, we talked about that Kevin Bacon movie for well over an hour, too. So there's that. But I get your point. I get your larger point.
I mean,
there's themes here. There's things they... So the question then becomes like, how aware of itself was it? I think very. So that gives it a lot of points. You know, it's not like they made a crappy movie and there happens to be this kind of later realized camp to it. They were trying to make a campy movie with Lovecraft themes and also say some things. I don't know. I just feel like it's maybe not a serious enough of a work, even in the campy world, to have it be like, I just feel like maybe we could do better if we're going to pick a Lovecraft movie for me to pass it with a P. For paranormal, so I'm gonna give it a P for pass.
Okay,
reluctantly, because I really did have a blast. I laughed. It was fun. It was interesting. I didn't know what was coming next, but it just doesn't pass that internal test for me high enough.
Well, I'm gonna have to think about this for a second because I hear you.
It's right on the edge,
and I hate this micro shelf thing where I have to kick other things off, but.
I love it.
You know, I mean, there's a part of me that feels like I not to put it on is genre prejudice. If I didn't put it on, if you're not putting it on, I feel like that's got to be mostly because of genre prejudice. And by that, I mean, like, there aren't a lot of movies like this. This is pretty out there. This is in the realm of, like, you know, Blue Velvet. And I'm not even saying that it's as good as Blue Velvet. I think Lynch is a genius, but I feel like there's room for movies that play this way, that are made this way. If they deal with this stuff in an entertaining way and don't totally, mess up the supernatural portion of it. I think they did a really great job with the resonator, with, you know, the seeming possibility that something like this could actually exist or be. I think that they did a great job of kind of like reinventing that story, because that Lovecraft story is only 6 pages long. You know, it's only
crazy,
a sliver of this movie. This movie goes places that the short story doesn't go at all.
Sure.
And so all things considered, you know, maybe I'd see the Reanimator and it would get shoved off the shelf. But until we do Reanimator,
that's what I was wondering.
I don't know.
Could we do better by Lovecraft is all I'm asking. And like you take like a Hellraiser, which is, again, so similar to this movie, maybe not quite as campy,
But I mean, this to me is a comedy. This to me is like almost like this is like I want to put it on the shelf for the same reason that I want a comedy to win an Oscar one day. Like it never does.
I got you.
Why does that mean it's not worthy of being on a shelf or being honored because it's not a serious movie? But at a certain point, like I don't even know what that means if you take into account that satire and surrealism are serious art forms. You know, are serious in other art forms, but I think they should certainly be able to be here.
I 100% agree with that.
I'm gonna put it on the shelf on my shelf, and
okay,
and then I don't know. Someone's gonna have to tell me what gets kicked off.
You are getting close. You are getting close to that number.
I'm sure I have to get rid of something now.
And now it's time for a new P4P segment. What did Siskel and Ebert say?
Our next film is called From Beyond, and it caught me by surprise because I'm the guy who was bored silly by the monsters in Aliens. But I laughed and sort of marveled at the creatures in From Beyond. I enjoyed this little horror film more than Aliens. It tickled me. I think this is a really good little picture.
It has some qualities to it. I like Stuart Gordon's last movie, The Reanimator, a lot better than this one, and I'm not giving this one a thumbs up, although it's marginal. And it didn't have the insane tension of The Reanimator. It digresses.
All right, so we split. On this movie, let's not split on our top three. So this is inspired, of course, by characters we meet right at the beginning of the movie. Both doctors, I believe, are wearing tremendous shoulder pads. She wears a blazer at one point that's like a tweed 80s blazer and just like, you know, fantastic 80s shoulder pads.
Barbara Crampton seems to be a petite person. I don't know. She doesn't look like she's a very, you know, tall person.
Right.
And they put shoulder pads on her that are as wide as she is tall. It's incredible. She looks like the gangsters from a Warner Brothers cartoon, like a Bugs Bunny cartoon. Yes. It's incredible how big they are.
Yes.
And
comically oversized glasses to match.
Yeah, just fantastic. It's like the quintessential 80s look that you could ever imagine. Yes, it was very inspiring. We're calling it, or I'm calling it, we didn't pass this by you, Maddie. I'm sorry.
No,
I decided to call it the Honorary Joan Crawford Award for Best Shoulder Pads. Joan Crawford, in case you don't know, was a giant movie star back in the 30s and 40s, notable for many things, including having very big shoulders. And so she tried to hide them for a long time. But in the 30s, designer Elsa Schiaparelli, who's influenced by the Surrealist movement, thank you very much, was doing work with the silhouettes of costumes and clothes that got MGM thinking about revamping Joan Crawford's wardrobe. So the head costume designer said, "I know you're afraid of your shoulders. We're going to make them bigger." And she was like, "James Caan bigger?" And he was like, "Yes." And so they went that direction, and she became famous for like having giant boat-sized shoulders in a lot of her movies. And then in the 30s it took off during the war too. So it's like, this is a real serious, we get some history here too, folks.
It's really good. No, folks, that was a great Arkin moment. We'll call it the Joan Crawford Memorial Shoulder Pad Awards, or we call it the David Byrne Same As It Ever Was Award.
Okay, that's a good one too. But he stole it from Joan. We know this.
Right, and he's not a movie star, really. He's a singer. So let's go. Let's do our top three. I think I started last week with number three. So, Tony, you want to start this week with number three?
Sure. My number three is the great Raymond Burr in the noir classic Raw Deal. The original Raw Deal, yeah.
Not the Schwarzenegger.
It's a great movie. No, not the Schwarzenegger. Damn it. I led myself into it. I did it to myself.
You almost got through an episode with no Stallone or Schwarzenegger.
Raw Deal, starring Raymond Burr. He plays a gangster in this movie with the biggest shoulders you've ever seen. I'll send you a picture of it, actually, because I want to hear your reaction.
I'll Google it right here.
I'm going to send it to you. It's right here. I gotta send the right one.
Raymond Burr. Oh God. Yeah, I'm looking. Yeah, it looks like a curtain rod going across his back. Yeah. And the suit jacket is just the curtains hanging off the ends of the rod. Yeah, that's ridiculous. Great call.
So yeah, great Raymond call. Burr.
All right.
From the classic
1948.
Noir, 58 something Raw Deal.
48 Raw Deal.
48. Holy smokes.
The second you said raw deal, my pineal gland stood at attention because I thought you meant.
You thought I talked about Schwarzenegger.
My number three is Holly Gennaro, who is Bruce Willis's wife in the movie Die Hard. And when he shows up to the Nakatomi Plaza, or what it was called. Nakatomi Plaza, thank you. She's supposed to be an up-and-coming VP, but she looks like an up-and-coming QB with her shoulder pads. So fantastic 80s moment. She's got the hugely permed hair and just these rockin' shoulder pads.
They were big, yeah. That was a statement.
It's lucky she didn't have to crawl through the ductwork because she never would have got through with the shoulder pads.
My number two is the actress Virginia Hay, who played Warrior Woman in The Road Warrior.
Great one. Great one.
She actually has shoulder pads.
Literal shoulder pads. Yes, you're right.
And I don't know if anybody wore them better in film history than her. That was a bit of a problem for me as a young boy when I saw that.
Yeah, it confused you, didn't it? It
did confuse me. And I was a good confusion, but I was confused.
Yeah. Because you had seen football players.
I'd seen football players, and then I saw this, and I had
Warrior Woman
feelings.
Yeah, that headband and the long flowing hair.
She was really fantastic. I mean, what a character! What a great performance she gave in that. And so yeah, that's my number two.
Your pineal gland extender didn't know which way to go.
Didn't know what to do with itself. I didn't know what's.
My number two is.
What's your number two?
1989 black comedy teen movie Heathers.
Oh, that was my honorable mention. Yes. Shoot.
Okay. If you Google Heathers, just Google Heathers, the first image you'll see is all the actresses, Winona Ryder, Shannon Doherty, I think it was Lisa Ann Falk and Kim Walker.
How did they all get into the shot?
They're literally all wearing Raymond Burr size shoulder pads on blazers, and it's incredible. It looks like a hair factory exploded next to a shoulder pad.
I have this cast of Heathers in my notes. I'm looking at it right now.
My number two. Actually, a good Brilliant. Movie, too. Funny movie.
Heathers is really good.
It is.
It really is really, really good.
Funny.
Okay, so my number one.
Drum roll.
My number one is I'm gonna go with Dana Scully in X-Files.
Perfect.
Because there are bigger shoulder pads in the world. Yes. I'm not. It's not the biggest, but I honestly think that if somebody says the phrase X-Files to me, the first thing I think of is her in those shoulder pads. This is the first
so
thing that comes
good,
to mind.
Dude. You're right. I just Googled
it's the silhouette of the show. Like it's what the show is.
And throughout the years, it never stopped. Like, even when shoulder pads were out of style, every blazer
with it.
She wore.
They were like razor blades, those things. They could cut. Right. They weren't like big, but they were dangerous. And she could use them. And I love that.
She tried to step on the alien craft. She like couldn't get through the door.
Oh, nope.
Excuse me. I had to go sideways.
They look modeled after an alien spacesuit, actually.
They kind of do. Did you see her, by the way, play the queen? And she doesn't play the queen. She plays Margaret Thatcher.
Margaret Thatcher had shoulder pads.
Yeah, and she's really good. She's really good. Wow. I think it was in the show The Queen, but she plays Margaret.
Okay. Thatcher. All right. Well, I love how she's now an English person now exclusively.
I know.
Maybe she always was. I don't know. She could have been born there for all I know, but now it's like she suddenly has just decided that she works there and now has an English accent, and that's what she is.
I'm all for it. Because every Brit plays every American character now.
Oh, for sure.
Right? So let's send a few of ours
and
over there.
And Australians.
No
kidding. We don't get to play any Americans anymore.
Maddie, correction, it's The Crown, and she plays Margaret Thatcher. And
thank
she's
you.
Really good in it.
I had Margaret Thatcher on my list, except I didn't think that it would be appropriate.
You've already mentioned Nancy Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, so you're going with every conservative woman that you love, and I know you have posters of them in your office.
I love. It's great.
They represent everything that you
Thank love. You for saying that on the air.
My number one, Tony, is a guy in shoulder pads, which is pretty much why it's shot to number one. Everyone always talks about the iconic boombox over the head, In Your Eyes by Peter Gabriel, but his trench coat in Say Anything has some great shoulder pads. And anytime you have a guy in a trench coat in the 80s and their shoulder pads, that's getting my number one. So it's Say Anything.
All right. I don't really remember the shoulder pads so much, but I remember the trench coat being stylish.
Google him. Google Lloyd Dobler in Say Anything.
And, dude, high tops and trench coats were the coolest thing to wear.
In fact, they were so kind of big, they actually fall off the edges of his shoulders. Or he might just have slight shoulders in real life, I guess, maybe. But they're just, it's just like kind of a perfect 80s.
Right, right. Not unlike Harrison Ford's trench coat in Blade Runner, which has big... I almost put that on list, but I did him last, like, a couple of shows ago.
And by the way, the girlfriend in that movie wears some shoulder pads, too. She's got a yellow dress on in one scene that's pretty good. So here, I just found an image of him here, and you can see he's in a music shop wearing that coat. And you can see, like, the extension end of the shoulder pads going past his shoulders.
Yeah, you know it's like a size 47. He's a 39. Yeah.
So there you go.
That's a good one.
Fun list. You mentioned you had one honorable mention that I took from you. Anything else?
Well, I mean, there's maybe Don Johnson from Miami Vice could be noted.
He almost made it on mine. Great one.
Melanie Griffith in Working Girl.
Yep.
Check. Very, very notable.
Yep.
Right, but I think really the walk away is the man that can do that without shoulder pads. And again, James Caan. I just saw The Godfather 50. He takes his shirt off and you're like,
oh, just
what's
his shoulders.
Happening?
Yeah.
They are the pointiest, giantest, tallest shoulders I've ever seen.
Yeah, it goes from the points of his shoulders and then it goes down and then back up to his neck.
There's
like a gap there.
It's not, he looks uncomfortable. He did have shoulder surgery. He's apparently has 16 screws in his shoulder. He did. But why does that doesn't explain the level of height we're talking with the shoulders?
It's very strange. It's very strange. Some honorable mentions I thought of were, and this kind of doesn't count because it was purposeful. And I think the spirit of this shoulder pad top three is that it was just of the time.
Right.
But The Wedding Singer, which is set in the 80s, comedy movie with Adam Sandler, like there's a couple pads that are so purposely over the top. They're really funny.
Yeah.
They're like characters in themselves, like the shoulder pads.
Right.
Priscilla Presley in the Naked Gun franchise some big shoulder pads. And then, funny, I had a memory in my mind, like a vague, I go, did Jodie Foster have shoulder pads in Silence of the Lambs dresses?
Oh, boy, she did.
Not only did she, but if you Google Jodie Foster, we're onto something here. I've never heard anyone else realize this. We have discovered this. Jodie Foster wears shoulder pads in every single film she's ever done. If you Google her, it's just images of her in blazers of some kind, and there's pretty big shoulder pads.
My guess is she has the opposite problem to Joan Crawford, and they tried the same approach.
There's something to it. There's something to it because it's
what
in
she needs
every
is
picture.
Somebody to go embrace your tiny shoulders.
Yes.
Use them.
Yes.
To your advantage.
Pull a James Caan and
she's a beautiful lady. She shouldn't feel bad about her shoulders. No.
Rock the shoulders.
Yeah. Whatever kind of shoulders you have, don't feel you need to wear shoulder pads. But if you like them, please wear them because they do look fun.
If there's any message we've learned today, it's let your freak shoulders fly and let your penile gland flop around however you need it. Into Tom DeLuise to boot.
You did.
We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Rated P for Paranormal. Please rate, review, and share. It really does make a difference. For more information, to participate, and even donate, go to our main page, anchor.fm/ratedparanormal. On social media, we're at Rated Paranormal. All music is by Andrew Galdens Jr. You can find him on Instagram at KidRiga or go to therocketscience.bandcamp.com. This podcast was created, written, produced, and edited by Maddie Blake and Anthony Arkin.
Can we call it the pineal gland, please?
But that's what makes it so grand.